guys, welcome back to Shooting the Ish with a Brit. I'm Jen.
And I'm David. Good morning.
Good morning to you. It's afternoon over here.
Oh, well, we're just about in the morning and you're just in the afternoon, so we're close.
Yes, but this means eating time, so that's why I'm very, like, specific. It's 12 o'clock, it's time for me to eat. My husband thinks I'm just a baby, that's all I do is eat, sleep, and poop, which pretty much I do. I'm a healthy person, okay? So this is why I'm like, it's 12 o'clock. It is the afternoon, aka eating time. What do you have to say, boo? By the way, my husband is here, and so is Coco. Thank you guys for joining us.
Y'all don't understand how serious it is for her to, like, eat on schedule to the point where she gets mean. And a very tiny woman, but she gets hella strong. It's like this deep hidden Hulk strength that she possesses when she's hungry. It's really crazy. Hungry and sleepy, so... David, you know, just as a fair warning, if you guys are somewhere and she's hungry, feed her.
Yeah, I have to say, I have a similar experience with Coco. Most of the times that I'm laughing the most at Coco is her reactions around food, and it just gives me so much joy. So much joy.
I'm not proud of it, but hey, we all have our things. I mean, you can tell the details of how I get around food. I think I'm a generous person. But when it comes to food, if I make a certain amount and he says he doesn't want any, and then he comes in and wants some after he already said no,
But that seems to be fine for Coco to do it the other way around. You know, it's not,
exactly,
not
David.
Quite
exactly.
A fair system.
Well, because you don't care, but I care. So
yeah,
different.
She does. There's even, like, let's say we're eating a pizza or something and we've got 50-50 of this pizza. Even if she knows I'm not actually going to take one of her slices, if I go, like, pretend to take one of it, she still legitimately gets upset at me, even knowing I'm not actually going to take it. Just the thought, the potential of it is enough to rile her up.
Hey, listen, women have very complex systems. We need our calories. We need our nutrients.
Pizza.
Whatever it is, in that moment, we intuitively know how much we need. So if you take that, then I'm left with, like, I need 3 more bites to feel satisfied, and then it's gone. That's not going to be a good night.
Hey, Coco, sometimes in life, you're not going to be satisfied, all right? That's just how it is.
I think that's explaining, David.
But one thing I can say that we were very satisfied with is the finale of The White Lotus.
Correct. But I'm not off of that topic of Coco. But Coco, you and I have to be long lost sisters because I am completely there with you. I cannot stand when he says he doesn't want anything to eat. Okay. I make what I make, okay, on my plate or my bowl to satisfy me. All right. But then here he comes wanting some of my biscuit, wanting some of my greens, whatever the hell it is. And I'm just like, why do you do? What is that? I don't understand.
I've just learned to make a little extra now for safety because I can't risk it.
I can't risk it for that chalky biscuit.
I feel the same way about my hoodies. Like, I buy her own. I just don't understand why I see her walking around in mine, or when I can't find the hoodie that I want to wear with this particular outfit. It's in her dirty clothes. You know why? Because somebody else has worn it.
I just don't understand how he doesn't get that's the territory of male-female relationships. That comes with it. The woman is going to wear the man's hoodies.
What I'm learning from this is there's so many rules for us, but there doesn't seem to be many for them. There's something wrong with this picture.
Hey, at least we're clear about it up front. That's the thing. We state the terms. I say, this is what I'm making. If you don't want any, you're done. I'm going to wear your sweatshirt. You know this. But you don't state the rules, so then it doesn't go the other way. If you're like, I'm going to eat some of your food all the time, then I prepare. I know.
We might need to get a contract in place. Terms and conditions.
You can pay the lawyer fees.
Amen. Amen, Coco. Okay, and with that, our beautiful guests are here to talk about The White Lotus season finale. So thank you guys for being here with us to chat about it. It's been a few weeks, so we've been able to digest it. We've watched it maybe one other time, and then we currently have it on TV to remind us. you know.
We watched it yesterday again, just as a little re-up, a little refresher.
Okay, very good. Okay, so this finale is called Arrivederci, which means what, you guys?
Farewell.
Bye. Goodbye, yeah. Goodbye, farewell.
It's a simple bye or farewell. And farewell to so many things, not just the actual season, right? In particular, one character that we will get into. So yeah, let's chat about it, you guys. Let's start off with the family of guys, the granddad, the dad, and the son. Coco, I want to hear from you first.
Ooh. I think they did a great job with this family, like using the three generations of men the whole time, and even the ending, like in the airport, just up until the very end, they all turn their heads as a beautiful woman walks by. I just loved the growth of all of these characters. I'm not sure I have anything too insightful. I was very pleased with like their trajectory, I guess.
Yeah, it was a nice dynamic.
I think for me, I just really loved how they exemplified how certain things can be passed through generations. Mm-hmm. And like you said, Coco, that scene at the airport was that in full course and full action. And think about it in your personal lives. Like, what are some of the things you got from your parents or your grandparents? And, you know, and it's even things that you hate that they do and you inevitably convey it as you get older. And it's like, damn it, I became my dad or I became my mom. So I thought that was just really great writing and how they convey that.
Yeah, there's only so much you can fight with your mind. You know, there's certain things that are just so ingrained in your personality before you've even had an opportunity to understand what your personality is.
I think too, especially now that it's been a few weeks since the finale, I think about that scene with them in the airport. As they're looking at the beautiful young lady. And I thought, you know what? I think every single one of them has a different thought. It's still in the same world of like sexism, probably, and lust in a way. But I imagine the granddad looking at her and be like, damn, I'm never going to get a woman like that ever. For Dom, I imagine him thinking, I might have to get another one of those when I go back home, unfortunately. And then I imagine Albie being like, she probably needs saving, you know? So I think, again, it's still the world of sexism and lust, but these different thoughts are so fascinating to me as they're all looking at this young lady. I also want to talk about how, it's on the screen right now, Albie asking for $50,000 from his dad to save Mia.
Lucia.
Why do I always get them confused? Lucia. The balls of that are grand for him to do. It worked. But the fact that, in my opinion, Albie would throw his mother under the bus in order to save Lucia was heartbreaking to me. And I say that he threw his mom under the bus because he knows what his dad is, you know? His dad is a work in progress, but unfortunately, he's not closer to being a better person. I feel like he's closer to still being an animal. You know what I mean? So at the level his dad is, he was like, you know what? I'll put in a good word about you to mom if you give me these 50 racks, you know? So I thought Albie, again, shows himself to be a mark, a simp, as his dad says the word mark. So yeah, that's what I have to say about those three.
I actually have a slightly different opinion on Dom. I think that at the end, he hadn't changed, but he had become aware of who he is and that the choices and actions he had made over the years had affected his father, his son, his family, his wife, his daughter. And so I actually think that Dom walked away from this whole situation with a different mentality. Like he realizes that the choices he made are not the right ones and he needs to kind of correct the course to rebuild the relationship with Albie, to build it with his daughter, to build it with his wife, or at least have any chance of that. And so the scene at the, you know, in the airport at the end when the woman walks by, you had said he's kind of looking at that thinking, oh, I need to get a piece of that when I get back. But I actually think he's looking at it like, oh God, I'd love to be, you know, with that woman, but that's past me now. Like, and that's the hard bit for him. That's the difficulty he has in that moment, is like, that's the old, like, I'm going with better intentions coming out of this. And that's the same reason I think he gave Albie the money. Like, it's just for the karmatic payment, as Albie put it. It's kind of this moment, this opportunity for him to show Albie that he can sacrifice things that are important to him, which sadly is money in this case, for even if it's just the opportunity to kind of show Albie he cares about him, even if it's in this really weird, messed up way. It's just kind of an opportunity. And obviously there is the quid pro quo element of it, but it's, especially having watched that again the second time, it didn't, the Dom felt a bit more, there's the more caring in it than there is just the quid pro quo element. So I don't think, like, whilst that is part of it, I don't think it's all of it. And I think his awareness has changed, and that's the biggest thing with him.
I agree with a portion of that, especially considering how the emotional arc of Dom was on full display over the past, or the latter few episodes of the season, from him looking at a family photo, crying, to, like you said, wanting to get closer to Albie, but not necessarily sure how to do so. And I do think the money was the first step of that. And I think the conversation with Bert, exposing Bert for what he was also a reminder of who Dom was becoming, if he didn't change his path, of course. So I agree with that. I didn't think about that until after I rewatched it, but I'm glad you touched on that.
Yeah, the conversation between him and Bert is actually a really notable one, because, as you say, it's kind of looking at the, oh, this is the future. And the reality with Bert was that we find at the end is he doesn't really regret it. He doesn't really kind of come around and think, oh, actually, maybe I've lived my life in a terrible way. He makes a joke about it. And Dom doesn't want to end up like that. He sees the pain that it's caused, and he doesn't want to repeat that pattern. So that conversation, as you say, is like, it's a really important one for his shift.
And it goes back to that word that you use, awareness. Bert never got the awareness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jen, I didn't think about that before, that Albie threw his mom under the bus to get $50,000 for a woman that he doesn't know. That's so Albie, isn't it? What a turd.
There's irony in that, I guess, as well. He wants to, really, it's about helping himself, because if he wanted to help the woman, it was, as you say, would have helped his mother as much as anything.
Right. Yeah, I didn't think about that perspective before.
Ditto.
Albie. He just comes across like he's such a good guy, but he's making a lot of weird, twisted decisions.
Well, he's selfish, right?
To look, it's like he's more concerned about his perception. Like, he wants to look like the good guy. Mm-hmm. So he's actually ends up doing bad things to look like the good guy. Interesting.
On the money. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anything else you guys want to say about these guys?
I don't think so.
I enjoyed them. Yeah, I thought they were a great trio. They're well written. The casting was great. Like, the balance of them was so funny. And it's nice to have watched their journey over that week, and I think a lot happened for them, and I'm grateful for that.
Me too. All right, next one we got is Valentina. So we saw her move into a sexual space that we weren't sure she was going to make it to, in my opinion. And she didn't lash out at anybody after the encounter, which was nice. I thought that was possibly going to happen, but it didn't. Honey, why don't we hear from you about your thoughts on Valentina's arc?
It was cool. I think what I disliked about it the most was, because she was not yet liberated around her sexual preferences, that she took that frustration out on men. And we saw that with the guy in the coffee shop, and we saw it with the gentleman at work. I forgot who became
Rocco.
Yes, we saw it with Rocco. She used to violate Rocco repeatedly. But we saw it again, even after her experience with Mia, in which I would say Mia freed her, essentially. We saw it against Salvatore. Like, hey, you're going to go back out to the beach. Next, you're going to be in the kitchen if I have anything to do with it. So I thought her arc was beautiful. I just hate that she had to utilize that repressed frustration against men.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm not sure if like Mike White is so good at the writing that your understanding of her lashing out at men could be because of her inability to like fully walk in her sexual preference. Like, I could totally see that, but I feel like the writing is also open-ended to like maybe creating a story about some other reason why she's like so violent toward men. I guess my idea is more of a possibility that maybe she was violated by men. I think that's a possibility. I think, I think several things could be the reason for that. But I appreciate your opinion on what that was. Valentina was nicer. You know, she looked very similar to that. What is it? A meme? Yeah, a meme of the Barbie with her hair disheveled when she came literally out of one of the suites to work. She was looking crazy as hell, and I guess expected nobody to notice. She was, even though she was violent, she was funny. And there's something about when a character is supposed to be unlikable, but they're able to like display humor that gets me, you know. I think something that I have to compare it to is this Broadway play that I saw recently, and there's an actor in there who we've seen in many movies before, and he always has an issue in general with acting, but he continues to get all these great roles. But on stage in particular, he plays a very unlikable character. But he plays it like that the whole time. And I'm like, what is that? You know, like, even though somebody's unlikable, he has to have some kind of likable characteristics. So what that actor did on stage, unfortunately, I don't think was a good choice. Whereas with Valentina, even though her lines are mean, you know what I mean? Like when she's talking to Salvatore and telling him to go back to the despacha, the way she says it is funny. You know what I mean? Like, it's not like, it's not hurtful, even though it is hurtful.
It's almost condescending.
It's condescending. Yeah, it is. I don't know. It just made, it tickled me. But yeah, I appreciated Valentina's arc again. I'm glad she arrived at some sort of niceness. What about you guys?
Yeah, I mean, I loved Valentina's character. Just, you know, as a character on TV, you know, she has her flaws and everything, but I really enjoyed watching her from the beginning, how she's just sort of seemed annoyed by everything. And she was sort of taking digs at the guest, even though she was the host of the hotel, like as soon as they got off the boat. So she's always just been kind of funny and irritable, like from the very beginning. And it's to the point of her being condescending to men, I think a thought that crossed my brain, which could be completely not true, is being a woman in business in Sicily. I can't imagine because there's more of an archaic structure,
patriarchy
in Sicily. So I'm sure, like, to me, I was reading that as her having to overcompensate to have authority, because in Italy, men have a lot more authority than women in general. So she's probably grown up feeling, not that that justifies it, but to me it made sense for her character in that time and place, because she's probably had to fight for a lot of things that she's had, and she's had to kind of be super direct and irritable in order for anyone to hear her, which sadly I think is the case for a lot of women. It's getting better now, but I think I kind of empathized with that, like even how Salvatore at the end like fights back with her. He doesn't just listen and say, okay. And then she has to keep going like, no, go. You're not listening. Go. So I felt for her there. But yeah, I just want to say, I think they did such a good job of making everyone their own little powder keg. That I love, like, Jen, when you said, you're like, I thought this could have gone a different way, or she could have lashed out. And I thought they did a really good job of just kind of keeping these little sparks going on everyone's storylines, where you weren't sure who was going to be the one that was going to break, or if she was, or if someone else was. But anyway.
Mm-hmm. I think for me, Valentina is the perfect personification of the idea that you can't love yourself. Sorry, you can't love other people until you love yourself. And I think her whole life, she has not loved herself because of the structure and society that she's been brought up in. The sexuality, obviously, is the big ticket item in this season. And she was, this season was about her coming to terms with that reality and also embracing it, like realizing that actually it's not a bad thing. And her, with her dynamic with men, I think that obviously plays a part in it. But the bigger part of it is that, as we've seen from her experiences, most men are condescending to her. They're sexualizing her. You know, they're kind of, they're looking not at her as an equal, they're looking at her as an object. And that's what I think she's had to fight against. And so it's just been a constant battle her whole life. And we know she's lonely in different ways, and she's not been able to speak out about it and whatnot. And so seeing her kind of come out of that shell and, you know, kind of grow into a flower towards the end and find her herself and find the love for herself was really pleasing. But then the last thing I said on Valentina is she's just also really funny. Mm-hmm. Like, she never let you down with a laugh, you know, and she's such a great actress, and they really nailed her part, and she nailed it. And I was really pleased for her.
Yeah. I like that they let her soften up at the end and they didn't have her close back up. Like, I like mm-hmm. that Mia came in and was like, I think you need a real lesbian lover. And mm-hmm. she was just kind of seemed excited about it and mm-hmm. was like, yeah, okay, I'll go to the club with you. And she didn't kind of clam back up and have that self-hatred of like, oh, what did I do? That was a mistake. Mm-hmm. I like that she just fully leaned into helping Mia as well and was just like, all right, this is who I am now. I'm going to help women. I'm going to go to the clubs. My life is going to, mm-hmm. I'm going to be more open. So I'm glad they did that, because I think I would have felt disappointed if they like had her filled with shame or regret and then she got angry again. That would have been kind of a bummer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, most people, most characters actually left the resort this week mm-hmm. or that week better off, the happier, mm-hmm. kind of more content in what their lives were saying. I mean, not all of them, obviously, which we'll get onto some of them, but some of them they did.
Anything else on Valentina? Okay, moving on to Mia and Lucia. Mia and Lucia, who I guess I saw in some interview, Mike White was talking about how some of the characters were inspired by Laverne and Shirley. I assume that was Mia and Lucia. We just have these, you know, two ladies getting off on people, I guess, you know. So who wants to start on Mia and Lucia?
I can go if you want. I'll give my quick little summary. Mia, she was just chaos, and I loved her. She's like a tornado kind of every time she came into every single room, and you know, aesthetically as well as mentally. But the big thing I kind of reflected on her, and you know, we've talked about her being kind of led down this path with Lucia, and kind of, you know, and then now she's embracing it. I actually disagree. I think that Mia embraced it so freely. All she had to be, all Lucia had to do was show her the door. Like, Mia walked through it and then she ran. She's like, okay, this is for me. I know I can work this system. I can see how this is. And I love that for her. Like, I love that she kind of had that epiphany and she's owning it and she's kind of using it to her advantage. Again, from a character perspective, obviously. And then Lucia, who I think is the smartest of all the people on that show, who really kind of, she just had her mark from day one, and just it evolved and she pivoted because she had to, you know, she kind of, okay, this is the situation. This is what I was trying for, but now there's another route I'm going to take here. We need to make the most of this. And she nailed it. And And even these aspirations of going to LA and whatnot, like in the reality in the end was really, she just liked having a good time, man. She just liked spending other people's money and kind of just living that life and just kind of playing the game. And I love that for both of them. They're both so happy at the end. Obviously, we see them walking down that street. I was very, very pleased that they got to that point in their journey.
Lucia was masterful. She was the ultimate chess player, and everyone around her, including her friend Mia, were pieces on the chessboard. And even thinking about her having desire to go to LA, I feel like that was a falsity, to be honest. I felt like that was just something that she used to get what she wanted, and she got what she wanted. My favorite element of her game was constructing this contentious moment with her fake pimp. And I was like, man, she has really thought this through, from following the DeGrasso men to their, you know, family home that they've traced back and the whole route of their trip. She really went all the way out. And it was just like, damn, like, salute to her. Like, sis really did it. And she really won, in my opinion.
Yeah, she was probably the smartest and also the most manipulative. She used her intelligence to, like, mold exactly what she wanted to get. But she was a great actress. I thought she was so powerful from the first episode, and she just stayed so potent all the way through. She was really fun to watch.
Just quickly on that note, that one of the things I did notice is though she was the masterful chess player, there's still an element of innocence about her, in that the moments when she succeeds, there's a little bit of surprise. And the best example I can give is when Cameron hands her the envelope. There's like, she's surprised actually getting that money. And it, with the 50,000, it's just like, you know, it's a bit of shock as much as anything that it's actually worked out. So that I think that made her more endearing and more likable, is that there was this, like, she's just taken a moonshot and she's going for it, and it worked out, and she's, you know, I like that.
Anything else on Mia and Lucia?
I think
Lucia actually serves as, like, how you said, she shoots for the moon. That's how all of us should think. Like, really go big and beyond. Just think about it. Let's look at it from a professional stance. Like, when you get a new job offer and, you know, they come with a number or they come with a compensation package, shoot for the moon. And I have been a prisoner of someone who has not done that. So, like, to kind of see it and just think about it holistically of ways to, like you said, shoot for the moon. Don't walk around here not asking for what you really want in all elements of life. Think about it. Relationships, dating, family relationships, setting those expectations, really expanding the parameters of what you want in life, because you only get one life. So she taught us, she taught me a lesson personally. So shout out to Lucia.
Mm-hmm. I think I'm going to move to Sicily and be a con woman.
Oh, I think you'll be good at it.
Hey, I'm good at anything I put my mind to, so I'll take that as a compliment.
All right, big head.
All right, moving on. The next group we have are the married couples. So Harper, yeah, I know.
Oh, they're some of my favorites. I love watching them.
Big groan. God. Harper and Ethan. Ooh, I'm disappointed in the names, for that they don't look like a Harper and Ethan. I think that's why I always am forgetting. You know what I mean? Those are not their names. Like an Allison and a Doug, because he seems like just very, you know? Yeah. So Ethan and Harper, and then who are the other people, y'all?
Daphne and Cameron.
Yes, Daphne and Cameron. So Coco, what say you about these couples and their choices by the end of the season?
I mean, from an entertainment perspective, great. From a personal perspective, stressful. Just watching the David. David is urging me to get closer to the microphone. He's very stressed, so I'm going to move forward to alleviate
an appropriate amount of worried. You know, I don't want to record this again.
Listeners, I am now 2 inches from the microphone. I want you to know. Thank you, David.
Thank you, Coco.
Oh, my God. what was I saying? Oh, no.
We're saying about the couples.
Yeah. Oh, the couples.
Stressful.
Stressful. Yeah, really stressful. Just so much twisted shit happening between all of them. And then the unfolding of more layers of twisted shit with Daphne and revenge. And it all felt so dirty and kind of dark and weird to me personally. Maybe some people are into that. Good for you if you like doing couple swaps on vacation. But that is, that's not for me. But I mean, the characters were incredible. They were all so good. Cameron was so hateable. Daphne was confusing and kind of sad because you felt like she sort of resigned herself to this life with this guy because she could have what she wanted and she was taken care of. And she was sort of by the end justifying that, you know, whatever, my life is amazing. So if he hurts me, I'll just hurt him back and I don't ever have to tell him and then we're even. And so it was just kind of this sad, I mean, to me, that's not love. Love is, you know, open communication and clarity, and that's not love for everyone. So, you know, for me, that was stressful to watch because I don't like secrets. But and then with Harper and Ethan, I guess, you know, David, I know you have a different opinion on this, but I didn't really like that they became more like Cameron and Daphne in the end. I thought that was sort of a sad lesson, like, oh, just give up and start fucking each other. And then you'll become closer as a couple because you'll have mystery and lies from each other. So I didn't like that twist personally. Glad they reconnected. It was just, you know, that's my 2 cents. I did like that I loved the scene of Ethan attacking Cameron, though, in the ocean. That was great. Very satisfying to watch.
I loved the couples. I thought they were some of the more interesting characters for me. Cameron, I'll start there quickly. Thank you, Coco, putting my head close to the microphone. Cameron, the most hated. Like, he's just a terrible person, and the sad thing about his resolution in this series is that he was fine. He got everything he wanted out of the scenario, even though he was just a terrible person the whole way through. That's the wrong lesson. That's a tough one. Daphne, I think she's just got it worked out for herself, right? I think she understands that life comes with pain, and she's found a way to manage that pain, and not only manage that pain, but turn it into pleasure. And find a way to kind of enjoy it as opposed to kind of loathe it or kind of live on it. And whether, you know, it's not for me, but I can, I can see why she does it, and I can see why it makes sense for her. And she has a great life. She's doing all the things she wants to do. She has kids, I suspect, with someone else, not Cameron, right? So we know they're probably nicer kids than they would be if they were Cameron's. And she gets to enjoy herself and whatever. Well, I mean, that Cameron's going to have nice kids? I don't think so.
Kids can still be nice. You don't have to assume they're going to be shitty kids.
Well, I think one thing we've learned about this season is it's all about nature and nurture, right? So, you know, if they're going to be nurtured by Cameron and have his nature, they're in trouble, you know.
Yeah, at least he's not present enough regardless for them to be influenced by him.
So. True. But at least they have a chance if they don't share the biology. You know, it gives them a fighting chance. Ethan and Harper... I love the twist that they kind of became Cameron and Daphne, or like a pared down version of them. For the story, I thought it was brilliant. I actually think that the funniest part of that, though, for me, is that Harper, she kind of entered the conversation adamant that they were terrible people and that they had a perfect life. They had a great life. They had great love. And so to me, she kind of came into it thinking she was the most aware, but was really the most naive about the world around her. And she really had to get her eyes opened up. And she was duped into this scenario, honestly. Like, they played her like a fiddle and they twisted it around. And in the end, she's kind of walked away. And she's like, she feels like a bit of a dope to me. She's been conned as much as Albie's been conned, for example, I think.
I don't know if she came in naive. I think that is, I mean, whatever. Harper wasn't my favorite character, but she saw things exactly as they were. Like, you know, she wasn't stupid. She came in and she saw that something was not perfect with them when Ethan was insisting that they were fine. But there did turn out to actually be all of this, like, cheating and lying. And, you know, she wasn't wrong, but she was maybe naive about her relationship with Ethan. But I don't know. I don't know if she was naive. She knows he was watching porn and that he wasn't wanting to have sex with her. I feel like she was very aware. She just ended up kind of giving in to something different at the end. But she wasn't wrong about Cameron and Daphne.
I think she was naive about the realities that that way of life is a thing and it's okay. And people live like that and it doesn't mean they're unhappy. That's where she was naive. She thought they can't be happy because they live, like as you rightly say, they live the way they live. But that's where the naivety, I think, is that she didn't think it was possible to be happy and to kind of be content in the way they live their lives. And that's the naivety I'm referring to.
I guess so. That's a bigger philosophical debate because I think to say that Cameron and Daphne are actually happy is a whole other argument. I guess that is how you define happiness or how you define trauma behavior, because you can become desensitized to a lot of different patterns of attachment, but that doesn't mean that you're actually happy. Like even when Ethan told Daphne at the end on the beach that he thought something happened between Cameron and Harper, it was almost like you could see her in so much pain. But she just then twisted it and switched to that like protective mode of her brain. It doesn't mean she was happy about it, but she then just goes and emotionally justifies it so that she doesn't have to feel the deep pain of Cameron. So I guess I wouldn't say that they're happy or that there was naivety with Harper. I think, I don't know, I have to think about it a little bit more, but I don't think that Cameron and Daphne are necessarily happy. I think they're good business partners who have an arrangement, but I'm sure there is like real love there in a different way, but there's a lot of hurt there, even if it ends up connecting them in some other way.
The one disagreement I have then is the moment of Ethan and Daphne on the beach. You kind of said it as hiding the pain. And I'm sure there is an element of that. But I actually really think, to me, I read that as her brain thinking, how do I solve this problem? And how do I get to the goal that we want to get to that's going to improve our lives and kind of maintain and you know, kind of grow upon it?
Yeah, but in therapy, that's going into logic instead of feeling. So she's not feeling her feelings. She's going into logic to protect herself from feeling her actual sadness and pain. When you go into problem solving instead of feeling, you're not actually feeling.
There.
We're going off on a tangent.
No, this is great. And I'm both of you said things that actually are in alignment with my thinking. I'll just kind of start first with, they were my least favorite characters throughout this entire series. Because of something you alluded to, Coco, in reference to when I look at it through my lens of how I approach marriage, it was disgusting. I hated it. It was just like, you guys are assholes, right? And you don't value the essence and the true meaning of what it means to take that oath in that union. So from my own projection, I hated it, right? But then when, you know, I kind of looked at it through the lens of their characters and how Mike White wrote them, it was just like, oh, wow, he's doing an excellent job. When I think about Ethan and Harper, they had no foundation. And that's why when you look at how easy, in my opinion, easy it was for them to be poisoned by Daphne and Cameron's ways, it was just like, oh, okay, cool. This is who we are now, right? That lack of foundation, that lack of trust with one another, and even in the beginning of the season, it just really was very apparent to me that they didn't have chemistry amongst themselves. they just seemed like two people who just were thrown into this marriage and it's like, hey, this is what makes sense at the time. So we're just going to continue to kind of go through the flow of the ocean and, you know, just be. Now, I don't think Harper was naive at all. Coco, you hit it right on the head. She saw things that Ethan could not. And we talked about this in an earlier episode this season in reference to your partner just has eyes and perspective that you don't have. That's the beauty of being in a union. So you could kind of receive those things. And I'll just say, as a man, it is a bit more of a challenge for us to receive that perspective than I think it is for women to do so. So she told Ethan very early who Cameron was. Cameron did everything in his willpower to deter her from what she already knew. So Ethan, it took him a bit more time to really get an understanding as to, one, Harper's not coming from a malicious place. Two, Cameron really is an asshole. And three, how is he going to be willing to accept that coming from his wife who just met him, in comparison to this longstanding history he has with this man? So that's what he was battling with, in my opinion. So I don't think she was naive by no means. Daphne, I agree. I think she's in full control, to be honest. Like, she is in control of her own happiness, completely independent of Cameron and his actions. She is not a victim of circumstance. She is a champion of this business arrangement. And she has found her light and her joy in that. And I think more than anything, she just values the institution that they have. I think very early on in, you know, maybe their relationship, kind of off script here, that, hey, that's who he is. That's who, like you said, David, that's who I trust him to continue to be. So let me find out how I navigate through him to find my own peace, joy, and happiness. Prime example is her kid with the gym trainer. I 100% don't think that's Cameron's. Those are Cameron's children by no means. So she just found her little pockets, and she alluded to that when they rented out that mansion when it was just her and Harper. Like, hey, you know, I kind of just do me. I spend money, I go shopping, and I enjoy life. So, but none of that says victim to me. Coco, you said it. There is some pain there, 100%. I don't think that was the ideal way she wanted to be married or live her life. But again, she just respects, like, hey, I'm going to be in this. I'm going to stay in this, but I want to be happy. So to sum all that up, I think, again, they continue to be my least favorite characters. Cameron left as a loser, in my opinion. Just that last little scene in the airport, he just really looked defeated. I don't know if that's because Ethan got one up on him and he knew it, or what the case may be, or he didn't get Ethan's business. Cause I think this was a part of the reason he invited the couple out to the vacation. One, to hit on this man's wife, cause that's what he's always done, hit on his women, but also to get his business. And I don't think Ethan's going for the business element at this point.
Mm-hmm. I think that's all well said.
Love all of this. Yeah. And then what I'll say lastly on them is, and I'll keep it short, I love the themes of like intuition and knowing without seeing. As you said, Boo, for Harper to have already known what these people were about is completely like such a woman's sort of intuition thing, just putting like two and two together and being like, this is what they are. And there could have come with that or came with that, like some kind of embarrassment from Ethan. Like you said, you know, how can my wife know these people this intimately without really knowing them? Then the other part of knowing without seeing was when Ethan said, you cheated on me. He didn't see it, but he knew that it happened. We also, as viewers, were challenged to put our knowing into practice without seeing. When Daphne and Ethan go behind those rocks or that cave or whatever that was, and there's no doubt that they had sex. We didn't have to see it to know it. So that probably goes to show you how good of a writer like Mike White, again, really is, for us to believe what we know without having to see. I don't think Daphne is happy whatsoever. I think she has happy moments. I think that she is a very committed person, which is admirable. She also understands that she doesn't want to embarrass her fellow business partner and husband. So they're not going to put all their business out there on Front Street like that. Unlike Cameron and what is her name?
Ethan
and her, Allison and Doug. Okay. So for Allison and Doug, they just have absolutely no foundation. They're completely built on sand. That's why they were able to go so wayward at the end, because they don't know who they are as a couple. Allison, she desired her husband to desire her. So she was going to do whatever she wanted to do to get him to desire her. And then for Ethan, I don't really know what he was really mad about, because again, he's not interested really in his wife, or attracted to her. Let me say that. He's not attracted to his wife. It could have just been the sheer disrespect of his friend inviting him on a trip and then violating, you know, him in the way of having sex with his wife. So yeah, I appreciated these couples as characters. I'm really glad that they were added. Anything else you guys want to say about these folks?
Just a compliment to Mike White again, that his ability to get into the psychology and backstories of these people so quickly with so much depth is just amazing. He's so good at that.
So good. And there's a lot that isn't said that allows us as viewers to fill in the blanks, which I appreciated a lot. Now that I'm watching series after this show, for some reason, other shows seem to talk too much. You ever kind of like way too much talking? The only time it works was when we watch Glass Onion, because my God, they talk from front to back. And I'm like, Jesus Christ, shut up. But it works for that sort of thing because it's so dramatic. You know what I mean? And like, whodunit? But like, yeah, I think shows, they talk too. They have the people tell you who they are without showing you who they are, you know?
Yeah. I agree. Some of my favorite films are films that have little, like such little dialogue, and you're just watching and you get to figure it out for yourself. And yeah, I agree. He does such a good job of showing and letting you figure things out or guess what's going to happen next without sort of treating you like an elementary kid and telling you everything that's about to happen or that just happened. So yeah, he's really amazing writer.
And I think to complement that particular element of the minimal dialogue is how he uses scenery to also convey those different, you know, contentious moments, moments of peace or whatever it may be with the water, the paintings. And I did stumble upon a Twitter thread, beware, just want to put that out there, that explained a bit more in depth as to why this particular location was utilized and the history of it being like a haven for homosexuals during the 19th century. And it was like powerful. And I think that kind of leads further into the history of Quentin and the element of why they were there. Like it has historical reference. So I thought that was like, you know, just again, brilliant.
Yeah, that's a nice insight. But yeah, the classic rule from any storytelling, particularly TV and movies, is show, don't tell where possible. And also make every moment count, right? No wasted moments. And this show is the epitome of that. You know, every second in this show was worth something. It meant something. It added something to a character of the story. And that's so rare to see. And it's wonderful. It's masterful. Oh, and sorry, that's the other thing I was going to say, that Mike White also does extremely well, which I commented on when we rewatched it, is the music in this show. Like the scene I commented on was when Tanya goes back into Quentin's bedroom to look at the picture again, and that music says, "Oh, you couldn't even necessarily even watch the scene, and you'd hear that music, and you'd know what was up, or to an extent." And he's just really, really good at making those choices as well.
Agreed. Great score. Whoever did the score, I don't know who did it, but good choice.
Excellent. Anything else on the married couples?
Mm-mm.
All right, Portia, her sad self. Why are you booing her?
Was she your least favorite character, Ishmael?
No, she wasn't. She, I'm just being silly here. When I look at Portia's storyline, it's just like, man, one, she doesn't stand up for herself. She allowed Tanya to just completely run her life amok, emotionally, and even to the point of physically, like she was just tired, right? But then there came a point in her storyline where Tanya tried to warn her before they even met Jack and Quentin of, like, you know, being mindful of the men that you allow into your life. Albie and her, like, they just deserved each other. Two simps, two idiots, who allowed these, you know, shiny objects to enter their space and just corrupt them, essentially, or bring out the true essence of who they were. I probably feel the worst for Portia, just in consideration with what happens to her off script and the end of the season, because she has to go back to the States and answer a lot of questions. Like, you went here with your boss, you know, what happened? And she doesn't have any answers, realistically. She doesn't fully know. I think it's that deniable plausibility that Jack blessed her with. That was a gift. But I think, you know, just the trauma that's associated with that. And, you know, granted, this is a, you know, a dark comedy, but I just think about, you know, kind of the implications around, like, man, my boss really died. We kind of figured it out. I was the last person to talk to her. Like, that's going to haunt her for some time. And I even think about Jack's last, like, advice to her of, like, you know, get on this plane. These are powerful people you don't want to fuck with. So I really feel like she was a loose end that was supposed to be tied, but Jack kind of backed off of it. So I just think about her safety.
I think she knows a lot. I mean, she knows what happened. Again, we go back to knowing without seeing. I mean, when she was talking to Tanya, she said something like, I feel like something bad is going to happen, something like that. Mm-hmm. She didn't know exactly how the puzzle pieces fit, but we go back again to that women's intuition, putting puzzle pieces together. She's being hauled off and deliberately separated from Tanya. Her phone goes missing. I mean, you just put all of it together, you know what I mean? And something is going on. So I think she does know. She knows what happened. I mean, the journalists are going to do their job, clearly, and the cops are going to do their job. But she has a lot of information. She knows exactly what's going to happen. And I, too, agree with you. I do feel bad about her having to, like, you know, be in the middle of all this and investigation. You know, this is post the season and everything, right? But I feel like Portia is just as sad and messed up as she was in the beginning. You know, I appreciated that there was no real evolution for her, you know, like somebody has to kind of be that constant. And I felt like she was that for us in this season. I think it's also understandable that she wouldn't have an arc. She's in her early 20s. In my early 20s, I didn't, what kind of art, what is that, you know? Like, I was in a sort of a constant just of just doing whatever, you know what I mean, for like a while, you know? So I didn't expect her to, like, change or be happy or anything like that. She's in her early 20s. She's trying to figure it out. So, yeah, I enjoyed her character. I thought she was sweet. She was funny. She was a funny mess to me. And then, you know, she's so attached to Jack, who I can't believe that's his real name. But again, he is the saddest story to me. Because as I said before on a previous episode with me and you, David, I really believe that's a human trafficking story. When he talks about how powerful these people are and you don't want to mess with them, that is, he is a slave, you know? And I know some people might laugh at that, but they're like, slavery is still like a thing today. And, you know, it makes me think of Game of Thrones, as I said before, and like the impoverished community of Fleabottom, you know? Like, I feel like he is from some place that is just seriously, that is dark and terrible. And Quentin came along and was like, you know, I can give you a better life. I can do this, this, and this. Just break me off from here and there, which is seriously, which is not even his thing, you know? So he's doing things he doesn't want to do. he is sad. He is a sad person. And I think I don't know. He's sad. It almost made me cry. I'm being for real.
That worst place that he lived in was Essex.
Thank you.
I don't believe that's really where he's from. I think that's a part of his story.
He's from Essex. Yeah.
You said Jersey Shore. Jersey Shore is not like...
No. I said that Essex is the Jersey Shore of England.
Right. But Jersey Shore is not like a poor, sad community. That's what I'm saying. Like, he is from the gutter. That's what I'm saying. Whatever that is, that's where he is from.
And I just got to say, this may be controversial, but I don't know that he didn't want to do that with Quentin. Because, like, how do you go in there with your strong arm if you don't want to do that?
Boo, it's an orifice. Are you for real? I mean, it's a penis, from what I understand.
Okay.
I'm going to jump in with
Ishmael here. There's the way our junk works, it has to have a mental stimulation, and there's no forcing that. I mean, at least from my experience, there's no forcing that. And that's pretty extreme forcing if you don't want to.
100%.
Okay.
That's
all right. Okay.
There's what about like porn stars? There's a lot of people that can get into a headspace and do something. They could think about something else. Who knows? No. We don't know.
They take injections, and they're getting paid with those injections. Seriously. Okay.
Got it.
But when it comes, like, even think about heterosexual men that have issues getting it up in sex. Like, sometimes
with women,
like, you just are not there. So it won't happen. So again, I can't all the way buy that he didn't want to do that.
Okay, I hear y'all, but again, he's a slave, okay? So when you think about it, this person is being held against his will. He's being promised X, Y, and Z, a better life than his life in Flea Bottom. He's going to have a mindset of, okay, I'm going to do this thing. I'm going to get this thing up because I don't want to go back to the gutter. When somebody is in a desperate situation, I hear where y'all coming from, but y'all are not being human trafficked. That's what I'm saying.
It don't work like that.
No, I got one.
You've never been human trafficked.
No, I know, but I've had sex.
You guys have never been in that situation.
I'm just saying you have to be open.
You have to be open to the possibility that in desperation, you might find a mental trick that would get you to a place where you wouldn't get killed.
I'm gonna go rob somebody.
And the thing is, the big thing that sticks out to me in all of this is you're talking as if Jack is thinking ahead to his future and what he's gonna do for the rest of his life. I don't think he's thinking like that. I think he's short term. What do I need to do in this moment to get to the next thing I want to get to? That's his agenda. He's not a smart guy. He's not a chess player. He's not a Lucia. He's a guy who's just surviving and but also wants to enjoy himself while he's surviving as best as possible. And so I don't think it's as extreme as you say, Jen. And I just don't think he has that much of an idea about what the future holds. It's about what the present holds for him.
You prove my point. He's a soldier. Soldiers follow orders. Mm-hmm. They follow orders. And as Coco said, this is life or death to him. He told us what kind of people these are. So I do think, as Coco said, you guys should think about the possibility, right? You've never been in a desperate, I've never been in a desperate situation like that, but I can understand how somebody can do things, say things that are out of character if they are trying to hold on to their life, trying to hold on to a roof over their head. That's how human trafficking is even a thing. I'm being for real.
The difference here is, I tell you what makes me really hard to jump on board with this is that Jack just isn't a nice person, right? So if you were to tell me you put Portia in that situation and she's making these choices, to me that's her out of fear and out of kind of going with the situation. Jack, no, he understands who these people are. He understands what he's doing. He understands the choices he's making. This isn't just based on fear. This is like, this guy knows what he's doing. He's just not a nice person. And he's very selfish. But,
okay. And I'm not defending Jack. Just this is...
Sounds like you are, Coco.
Well, I think Portia and Jack are going home to two very different scenarios. Yes. Portia has to act from a certain place, but she has a safety net at the end of the day. Jack clearly has stated that he comes from a very, very dark place. So even this dark place could be better than the dark place he came from before. So I'm not saying that you guys are wrong. I'm not saying that there, for most men, most of the time, you have to be emotionally stimulated to get an erection. But I'm just saying, consider the possibility that there are other scenarios. Even think about men who couldn't be openly gay for years and they were married their whole lives. Like, they had to figure out a way to have sex with their wives. It's not just that black and white. Like, yes, the preference is to be emotionally connected, but you can still do things you might not want to do to keep your life a certain way if you're desperate.
I tell you the slight problem with that. I agree with that, and that all makes sense, and that is a reality. The thing is that when they were having sex, when we saw them having sex, it wasn't like a slow caressing kind of him getting in his head. They were going at it. That was like animals.
That proves the point even more. Like, it was like aggressive. Like, he wasn't being loving and affectionate. Like, they weren't in love. It was like he's getting the job done.
I'm gonna just say this. I'm gonna go back to our earlier point of, like, you know, what was it? Showing but not saying or something.
Yeah.
I'm gonna just operate on the understanding that he took a pill prior to, and that's how that situation worked out.
Agreed.
That's interesting.
On Portia quickly. The thing with Portia, she is probably the most passive character in the whole show. And I think that's the reason she's kind of got to where she got to, and the reason she made the choices she did, because she's not someone that leads her life. She's someone that lets life lead her, right? She just kind of goes with what life throws at her and doesn't really push back from it. And I think that's her problem. And Albie, by the way, to your point, Ishmael, is, you know, being the simp, he is similar in that way. He's just kind of reacting to what life's giving him rather than kind of leading with his own agenda and really a sense of himself, and which is why I think they're probably perfect together, because they'll both just be passive together and boring.
I think
that's dangerous.
I think Jen was right when she said that Portia's just in her early 20s. Like, I don't think we really even know who Portia is. We've just seen this sliver of who she is now, but she's like the quintessential American girl mess who doesn't know who she is. She doesn't know what she wants. She feels like everything's happening to her and she's out of control. It doesn't mean she's not going to get control at some point in the future, but the slice of life that we saw of her is just this messy, overwhelmed, confused girl who just doesn't know which way is up. And that was like her, she served that role in the show very well, I think.
Agreed.
Anything else on Portia?
Who would have thought Jack and Quentin been the two that made us get into this kerfuffle? I love that.
I know.
My last thing is, Portia, why didn't you get out of the car when you thought you were being kidnapped? Why'd you get into the car?
Because she's passive, man.
She's scared.
Life happens to her.
She's scared. I feel like you're not being very compassionate to her, to a confused 20-something-year-old girl who felt like she got kidnapped.
I think I'm just being just straight up what it is.
Yeah, but she's not an idiot. She's terrified. I'm not saying I agree with her decisions, but I don't think she's... I was very passive most of my life out of fear. So I'm just saying, you know, through my lens, not through the show's lens.
So what you're saying is you agree and that she is passive. That's all I'm saying.
No, I'm saying she could maybe not be passive, but maybe that's who she is now because she's messy. Wow. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
Keep talking about it, Coco.
Oh, you're annoying me. Move on.
Coco, I'm with you. She was terrified, but that was even more reason why I thought she would have got out of the car and ran, or at least made an attempt. I just needed one attempt, right? Because when fear kicks in like that adrenaline starts rushing and it's either fight or flight. But to David's point, she just became so passive. It was just like, yo, you out here fucking your uncle.
You say fight or flight. She did neither.
She didn't. She
of those
just
two choices, she did neither.
But I don't know if that's passive. I think she was frozen. You know, there's like the fawning response in trauma where you just freeze. Like she just froze all the time. She didn't know. She was always afraid of doing the wrong thing or getting in trouble. So she just did what people said to her. But I think she does have strong opinions in there somewhere. And they started to come out at the end, like listening to herself. But she's just young and messy. I'm just saying she could still be passive a little bit, but I'm just saying give her a little credit that she's just young trying to figure her shit out.
Agreed.
Finally.
We need a shirt that says that. Agreed. That's pretty funny.
It's weird for David to say that.
How dare you?
David's is usually like, well, actually, that's yeah, David's basically. T-shirt.
Or the problem with that is, yeah.
Well, not cool, man.
Yeah. Anything else on Portia, you guys? All right. Last but certainly not least, Miss Tanya. Miss Tanya.
R.I.P.
R.I.P. She didn't make it. She didn't make it at all. But she went out
on her terms.
On her terms. On her terms. I actually want to start with this. Iconic line. As we know, the gays are trying to kill me. What a line. What a line. So beautiful. So Tanya is tipped off by Portia pretty late in the episode, now that I think about it, that something crazy is about to go down. Tanya realizes, oh my God, the picture I saw in the bedroom was of my husband. My husband is plotting to kill me. And these gays are going to do the job. Along with some mafia guy, right? So Tanya, for me, just in general, because I do kind of have to talk about season one Tanya a little bit. Tanya is not, and I have to remember this, Tanya is not, should I say this? Tanya is not like a good person. I wouldn't use that word good person. Like, she's not a kind person. That's what I'm trying to say. She's actually not kind. She's very funny because she is very, she's kind of naive about the world. And I wonder if that's due to her worth of $500 million or something that she inherited, you know, from her family. So she says a lot of things that are very naive, but then she'll have those moments of like wisdom, you know, like we saw her showcase with Portia and trying to tell her, you know, you might want to be careful with the men that you entertain, you know. I appreciated her dying at the end of the episode. It just made a lot of sense. I would have liked to have seen her in season three, but I'm glad that, you know, Mike White did not choose what we would like to see and went with what makes sense for the story. So with her not being a kind person, you know, and all these other things, particularly, I kind of still have a bad taste in my mouth about what she did to Belinda in season one. It makes sense that she died. It just makes sense. Maybe a little bit of a karmic payment. I don't know if death is like, that might be a little too much of a karmic payment. But whatever. Yeah, I feel bad for her dying, but again, it makes sense. All that kind of stuff. Yeah, that's all I got.
The way she died was the funniest TV death in history. Like, man, the clonk. It's the little boat. It's funny. Take us through. So she peeped the scene, she at the table, she like, oh, they about to get off, boom 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 boom, so let me go buy some time, let me go steal this bag, I'm gonna take it to the bathroom. She in the bathroom, she get the bleak, which is the gun, aka the hammer, the burner. She get the burner, she's like, all right, cool, they gonna break up in here, I'm gonna shoot my way up out of this joint. Next thing you know, she start bow bow bow, mind you, her eyes closed. So the fact that she even hit people is even more hilarious, right? So then she like, oh, I got to get the fuck up out of here. I don't know who else on this boat. She turn around. She hearing footsteps. It's the man. It's the captain who she was trying to talk to earlier, who she was trying to plead with. Like, yo, the gay's trying to kill me. Only word he understood was gay. And he was like, yo, I'm gay too. So she was like, oh, he may be in on this plot, right? Then she completely neglects to remember that there are stairs or a ladder on the back of the yacht. So that was also hilarious. But then something I thought about, like, one, why wouldn't she take off her shoes? But I think back to season one. Do you guys remember when she was laying out on the beach? She had her shoes on then too. She never took her shoes off. So that was true to her character of like, oh yeah, I'm gonna leave these heels on because I gotta look fly when I leap to my death.
And man, when she jumped, it was the funniest thing ever. So that's like my little breakdown of how she went out. RP time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really came around to appreciating Tanya's death. At first I was a little sad, but it was perfect for her. It was poetic. It was operatic. You know, she went to see the opera. She died in her own tragedy. And I think in a way her death felt like a relief for Tanya, like dying and floating in the ocean. It was like she was just always in so much drama and confusion, and people were pulling one over on her. And then it was kind of just like, all right, Tanya, you can relax now. It's over. Kind of felt, you know, in the way that the lighting on her face with the operatic music and everything, it was just, I thought they just nailed it. But Jen, to your point, I think she's very, how you said she's naive and not really a good person. I think she's very emotionally stunted. It's almost like she just got stuck as like a 10-year-old girl and she never really grew up. And so she kind of makes decisions kind of like a bratty 10-year-old like would make decisions. But and she played that character so well that she really was just like a giant child who was kind of naive and believed, was super gullible. And like one of my favorite lines was after she looks at Quentin at the end, after she shot him, and she's like, is Greg having an affair? And it was just like to the end, she just couldn't put the dots together like confidently. She still had to ask these super, super obvious questions that just made her character so comical.
You used the word brat. That was going to be my summary, which is she's a spoiled brat. You know, that's all she's ever known. She gets everything she wants. she gets everything she wants, and she lived true to that to the whole way to the end. And we mentioned a couple lines, Ishmael. You mentioned one earlier, and Jen, Coco, you just mentioned the one about the question to Quentin. But my favorite was you got this girl, as she just before she plunges to her death, and that feels to me like her internal voice has been saying to her every day of her life, kind of, you've got this girl, right? You're going to do it. And right up until the end. And she didn't her whole life. Like she kept, you know, getting into these situations with men or whatever it might be, just because of her spoiled bratness, her innocence, her naivety, whatever, you know, inability to walk through a normal life, whatever it is. And so to see her at the end, kind of come out on instinct, this survival instinct, which is exactly what it was, that kind of, you know, she saw the opportunity with the gun, got it. As you said, Ishmael, had her eyes closed, like screaming, tears coming out of it. She sounded like a dying animal, but she's just firing this gun and you can just hear these bodies dropping.
Oh, that scene was so good.
It was just brilliant, absolutely exhilarating. And they did such a good job of just placing it on her, and really, like, it was all about how she felt and how she experienced it rather than the result, because we were always going to get that. We were going to know what happened a minute later. So to focus on that was a really good choice. And look, she won, she succeeded, and I'm very content with that. And I'm also content that she died, because I also think about the Greg story and next season and whatnot. If she hadn't have died, what are we going to end up in a courtroom? You know, that's not the White Lotus. You got to, the new story's got to be clean cut. It's got to be something fresh. It's got to be kind of, and if she's still around, it wouldn't have had that levity to it, and that weight to it. Which are, I know, are contradictory things, but I think you know what I mean.
Yeah. Oh, and side note, Portia definitely knows that she died, because at the end when she's talking to Albie and he said that they found bodies on a yacht, of course she knows. Mm-hmm. She knows what happened.
Yeah.
Hey, Coco, I want to... Oh, go ahead, David.
No, you go, please.
Oh, I just wanted to, you know, harken back to something you said, just in reference to like how she has like this stunted 10-year-old mind. It takes me back to season one, where she talks about how abusive her mother was to her. And it's like, that was what we were introduced to her as. So to see her go through life, David, like you said, with this, you got it, girl, you go, girl. It's just like, she never had it. And that's what Greg leveraged, the fact that she never had it. Mm-hmm. So he used what she gave him to, you know, scheme up this plot to take everything from her. And, you know, he tried to manipulate, well, he didn't try to manipulate, but he manipulated her, but also utilized Quentin to do his dirty work to remove him from it. So, yes, she was completely stunned.
Also, can we just talk about the fact that there are people in this world that do this?
Right.
like, I'm not naive, but just when you really think about like, oh, this is not just something that happens in a show. Like, people really plot out murders to get money. It's crazy. Yeah. Anyway, side note.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard for me to fathom through my own lens.
Mm-hmm. How would you plot to kill me, Coco?
Oh my God. I would just, all I'd have to do is leave out a trail of chocolate that led to the edge of a cliff.
Damn it, you got me.
With a joint. I leave a joint at the end and he'd try to grab the joint hanging from the string and he would trip.
Yeah. Yeah,
but I wouldn't kill you, so rest assured.
Oh, phew.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a relief.
But if I had to, I'd give you all your favorite things right before you
just went like
out.
They did with Tanya. They were trying to give her a nice send off.
Exactly. You I'll know? Give you a nice send off. Yeah. Make it quick.
Be sure to get that insurance policy.
I also want to say, going back to Coco's point about Tanya's death being poetic, we saw in season one that Tanya's mom's ashes was spread on the water, and then Tanya ended up dying in the water. So I just thought that was cool.
That is nice. And I'd actually add on the waterfront, the whole season we've had these cuts to this chaotic ocean and these waves crashing and whatnot. And I think as summarized, that's Tanya, right? It's her internal emotions. And then at the end, she's peacefully, angelically floating in this calm ocean, just with this light kind of hitting her face. It was so peaceful. Mm-hmm. And it was, so I feel like that layering in was her emotions most of the time.
That's interesting.
And were there any other characters in this series that we want to talk about that are not necessarily people? Like, you brought up the water. Because I'm asking the question as I'm answering it. The volcano, as we have it on the TV, we did see some shots of the volcano. Mm-hmm. But in the in this last episode, the volcano is erupting as Tanya is killing people, you know, one by one. So I thought that was a really good element to use, just to show the eruption of the violence, the eruption of all these different things happening in this episode. But is there anything else besides people that were characters?
No, I think to your point, I love in The White Lotus how they use shots of nature to kind of churn things up, like as you're watching. And the symbolism of things like the heads and water, and just that you have to do so much research just to get the characters right. And then all the research, like even when Ishmael was bringing up how there's history of like the gays having this sanctuary in Sicily, and there's history of that, like just how much thought goes into that show. I think you really feel all of the thoughtfulness and the intention and the intelligence in every single choice. There's nothing is fluff. There's nothing frivolous. Like, everything has like a meaning or a purpose. And I'd actually love to hear him talk about that. Like, if he just went through and watched an episode and explained like all of the choices he made and why, it would be really interesting to hear how his brain connects everything together.
Yeah, I'd like you to do the same thing for yourself sometime.
Oh, shots fired.
Well, just for my understanding, you know, it'd be really helpful.
David needs a nap this morning. It's a little tiny.
Anything else on Tanya? Okay.
I'll just say the sound of her hitting that boat was horrific. That was,
shout out to the Foley artist who did that, whoever it was.
Seriously.
Good for you.
Listening to that sound over and over in a studio. I just wanted to acknowledge Tom Hollander because I thought that he was amazing. Mm-hmm. We didn't really talk about him, but I just want to say I think he played that character so well. And even just like his subtle turn of how in the beginning he just seemed like this warm character that was going to save Tanya's trip. And he just thought she was so fabulous. And you're like, oh, good, she's having a great time. And then once they got on the boat, you started noticing the undertones of like, you know, well, we're in no rush. And like the way he changed his, I don't know, he was just great.
Using lines like, has she gone into Hades, whatever it is, like she's like so many death lines.
Yeah.
Moody.
Yeah, so yeah. Moody. He turned so dark so quick when it was just like first a dream and then he was just so good at saying things the right way, where you, like you said, you could feel it instead of being told. You mm-hmm. could just feel his energy was shifting. It was really good.
Yeah, his eyes were crazy emotive. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Good job, Tom.
Anything else on agreed. Tanya?
That's our second agreed on the podcast. It's good this is recorded.
No. I think actually there might be three. There might be three, Coco.
Oh, wow.
All right. Awards. Golden Globe Awards were announced a few weeks ago. Our awards are way more important than that. So we're going to do five awards. First up, most hated. Coco, who does most hated go to?
Cameron.
Greg.
Oh, good one.
Yeah, Greg, duh.
I'm going to switch to Greg. Yeah, he tried to murder.
Right.
So Cameron sucks, but he wasn't trying to kill people.
Right. Oh, boy. All right. That goes to Greg. Second award, the biggest dope. David.
Harper.
Oh. Oh, I like that one. Mm-hmm.
Ethan? Tanya. No, Albie. Changed mine.
And for me, it's Tanya.
Mm. I'm going to go with Harper. That's a good one.
Right?
Right. Harper's got it. Congratulations to you. Dope. All right. The third award. Biggest come up. Who had the biggest come up?
Greg. Which, yeah.
Dark but true. But who knows? He might not get away with it.
Greg is at the house punching the air in excitement at this payday he's about to get. He's like, damn, Quentin did it.
Yeah, there still has to be an investigation. Still has to be an investigation of the person who was in insurance. But I'm going to go with the ladies, Mia and Lucia. What about you?
I agree.
For me, Valentina.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. But I guess Lucia wins that one.
Yeah, Mia and Lucia. Biggest come up. All right. Most liked award. Who does it go to, Boo?
Most like. This is a... not a main character, but a supporting character, and I'll say Isabel.
Oh, that's sweet.
She was she was very likable. Great smile. She wasn't malicious.
Receptionist.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going with that. When she was the sweetest thing. What about for you guys?
Go ahead, David.
I'm debating between Salvatore, just for the comedy value. but also, actually, Daphne, and more from the interest side, that I think she was just one of the most layered and most complex characters and actors that played a character. And she fascinated me more than others, like looking inside her brain.
I'm going to go with... I'm going to say Valentina, because she just made me laugh. She's just funny. I don't know if she was like the most likable because she was kind of cranky, but from an entertainment perspective, she was funny.
And I think Bert deserves an honorable mention.
Okay, so this was going to Isabel. Sweet Isabel. Lastly, the most heart racing scene. David, who does the most heart racing scene? What's the most heart racing scene?
I think for me, it's when Portia and Tanya are on the phone and kind of putting all the pieces together, and knowing that Tanya's sitting there on the boat and also Portia's there with Jack is just terrifying. But the most heart racing thing about it is that they both took so long to get to the end of it, and you just like knowing that that's the conversation in that moment. I'm like, neither of them are going to kind of come out of this on top. Like, they couldn't even work it out, let alone get out of it.
Definitely Tanya taking the bag into the room and then shooting everyone. Because even when we rewatched the episode, like that scene was really good, David. But when my heart was like the strongest still when Tanya was about to kill everybody.
Yeah, I actually agree with Coco.
I'm going to say when Portia revealed to Jack that, hey, I know that you were having sex with your uncle.
which further proves, in my opinion, I don't think that he was super against that, because, man, he didn't punch her through the wall, through the window. He just kind of like, oh, okay. I thought he was going to kill her then and there. So the composure that he kept after she revealed that, salute to him.
Mm-hmm. All right. So the most heart-racing scene, I don't know. Yeah, yeah. It goes to when Tanya is like getting ready to kill people. Cool. Very good awards, guys. All right. So apartment 4E. What do you guys want to put in apartment 4E from this season, I think? Yes. Yes, yes.
I can start if no one's got one.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm going to put in Hannah Montana. And the reason I'm putting Hannah Montana in there is because if Hannah Montana didn't exist, Portia's outfits wouldn't have existed and she'd have had a better chance at life.
Oh my God, harsh.
Yeah, that is harsh. That's a lot.
That's a lot. That's a lot to process.
It's a lot.
He thought about that.
Did think about that. You've been saving that one for like 48 hours.
Sure. Yeah. I think probably about 24 hours maybe. Yeah.
For sure. For sure.
I knew what my apartment 4E was going to be.
For sure.
I'll go last. I'm thinking.
So I'll go. Easily, I'll put in there just kind of the course of action that people will take to accumulate money.
Mm-hmm.
The evils that it will bring them down to. Greg is a prime example of that. Quentin, another example. The evils that entrapped or enslaved Jack. And Coco, you said it earlier, like, people really do these things in real life. This is not, you know, a fabrication of someone's imagination. Like, there's some reference points somewhere. And, you know, we see it at all scales, from the billionaires, the one percenters, all the way down through, you know, people that we may know, you know, like, they just do things that will completely ignore moral compass to accumulate money. And it's sad.
Yeah. I want to put in Harper and Ethan's names. They're going to go, they're Allison and Doug, because I don't know what the hell Mike was thinking about. Those are not those people's names. So that's what I'm going to do.
Is that Allison with two L's or one L?
That's an excellent question. So I think she looks more like a two L's person.
Good.
That's
what Definitely two L's.
Yes.
I'm going to put in like that feeling when they, at the end, when Cameron and Daphne and Ethan and Harper all sat down to dinner and pretended like nothing happened.
Yeah.
That was just, I hate that. I hate when people pretend like they all just like, they, literally he got punched in the face and then they just all showed up like, oh, hey guys, it's our last night at dinner and no one says anything. So I'm going to just put that, the what is it, like a facade. Put that thing in there. I can't stand that.
Putting on a front.
Yeah.
That's the best acting and worst acting in the whole show, that scene.
And then lastly, before we head out, where would you guys like to see season 3 set?
I think Thailand or something. Because Mike White hinted at there being some sort of spiritual afterlife element. So I think that would be a really interesting place to set it. So we can maybe go into some thoughts on reincarnation or karma, or, you know, which would be kind of a nice way to explore the characters after all of the shit went down. Like, what are they dealing with now? And maybe kind of fuck with their heads with things from the beyond.
Mortality,
yeah.
I'd like to think, for the show's sake, there would be a White Lotus in Tibet. I just feel like that would create a lot of controversy. I'm just going to leave that one there. I think it'd be quite funny, but also terrible.
Ooh. And since Mike did say the East, Bali would be nice. I loved how it was shot in Eat, Pray, Love. It's like one of my favorite movies. So Bali would be fun. It'd be beautiful.
So F both of y'all to the co-host of this podcast, because Tibet was my number one and then my backup was Bali.
So you say. That's very convenient to say.
The deal is, if it happens in Bali, then we have to record the next season in Bali. How about
love
that?
Love it.
Hey, Coco, don't tempt me with a good time. Yeah, I think those would be incredible places. Thailand, I think, is also excellent. Like, I think about Phuket, essentially. Man, I'm excited. I'll just say that. I just want to conclude the segment with that portion. Like, I'm extremely excited. I'm happy that Jen introduced me to this show, because I was looking for something to watch, and I was just completely blown away by the depth that was displayed here. Like, bravo.
You're welcome. All right, guys. Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of Shooting the Ish with a Brit. We've really enjoyed you guys so much. Your insight has been invaluable and fun, and we hope that our listeners have enjoyed it as well. What are our hopes for the next season of our podcast, David?
My hopes are still mulling around in my brain. I have a few ideas which we're going to talk about very soon, but I'm excited for it. I feel like we're getting a better sense of what we want to do here,
which
is an exciting time after six seasons.
You know, while we have these guests and they're also listeners, do you guys have any hopes for our next season in particular?
Yeah, bring us back.
Oh, okay. No, all right, but good to know. Jeez Louise.
No, seriously, I just hope you guys continue to keep going. Like, this is an excellent podcast. I'm very proud of you both putting in the time and the effort. This is not easy at all, especially being professionals, trying to maintain relationships. So kudos. Like, I'm inspired by this podcast, and I really do appreciate it.
I agree. Thanks so much for having me. It's been fun.
You two have been very welcome, and it's been it certainly added another element to this conversation as well. Thank you.
For sure. All right, we'll see you guys next season. Until next time.
Until next time.